The world rejoiced when the Berlin Wall fell, marking the end of the Cold War. Our main enemy in the Cold War, the Soviet Union, fell apart into separate countries, all looking ahead to greater freedoms. Fast forward nearly 30 years to our time, and yes, there are many more democratic governments in the world and a number of disappointments. Russia has not lived up to the post-Soviet promise with Vladimir Putin firmly in control. Poland and Hungary have turned nationalist and more authoritarian. That's just Europe. Other examples abound. Our guests this hour take a look at many examples now and in history in their book, How Democracies Die. Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt both teach at Harvard University, where they are professors of government. Stephen Levitsky's work focuses on Latin America and the developing world. Daniel Ziblatt's work focuses on Europe from the 19th century to now. They have both written previous books and been published in the New York Times. Daniel Ziblatt, thanks for joining us. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yeah, that's right. Thank you.
Okay, Stephen Levitsky, good to hear from you.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Is it safe to say with your research on different parts of the world this was an obvious joint project, Stephen?
I don't know if it was obvious, but Daniel and I started to converse really in the hallways as the U.S. election, and particularly in the primaries, progressed. Because, yes, for both of us, despite the fact that we study different democracies in crisis in different periods of history, this was a movie that both of us had clearly seen before. So we started to worry and we started to talk.
Daniel Ziblatt, many examples from Europe, even in recent times, not just back in the Mussolini and Hitler days.
Yeah, so I study in my own research before writing this book. I studied at the 19th century, the 1920s, 1930s, as you mentioned, but also contemporary Europe, and teach courses at Harvard on this. And so, you know, I had been alert already to kind of this resurgence of populist authoritarianism, which has, you know, swept across Western and parts of Eastern Europe as well. And so it was sort of very easy to see at some, you know, at some point was a controversial proposition, but now I think is commonsensical that the Trump presidency and the movement supporting Donald Trump is part of a broader wave of dissatisfaction with the functioning democracies in Western and advanced democracies as well.
Are we then, Daniel, essentially going down the checklist of how democracies die ourselves?
Well, you know, we're not quite so pessimistic. I mean, that we clearly saw some resonances during, I mean, as Steve mentioned, it was, you know, we've taught courses together on democracies in crisis around the world, but we were in the hallways talking to each other, you know, in between meetings and teaching, and some of the things that we saw that scared us in the presidential campaign, or during the presidential campaign, candidate Trump kind of failed what we regard as a kind of litmus test of authoritarians in the making. So some of the things that candidate Trump had done was he went after the media and, you know, called the media the enemy of the people. He wouldn't necessarily, and one of the big things for us is he, in this one of these debates right before the election, said he wouldn't necessarily accept the results of an election. He threatened to lock up his rival, Hillary Clinton, if elected. And he's condoned violence, really, at these political rallies, these really frightening scenes, from our view. And a lot of people thought this was just talk, but in our experience, these are radical departure from what any presidential nominee candidate had ever done in American history. And this was also something we had seen in other countries. So this was the first step, anyway. We have some hope that our checks and balances are working, but at least as a first step, this is certainly worrying.
Stephen Levitsky, you point out that since the Cold War, it's been rare to see a country become authoritarian through military coup. I mean, what are the normal procedures then for flipping a country into something less democratic than it started?
Well, these days, as you pointed out at the outset, since the end of the Cold War, since the fall of the Berlin Wall, democracy continues to have great legitimacy across much of the world. And so old-style military coups and government by military junta is much less common than it used to be. So much more common. In fact, a majority of democratic breakdowns since the end of the Cold War have come at the hands of elected leaders themselves, particularly in countries not like the United States, countries with much weaker democratic institutions. It's pretty common for elected presidents or prime ministers to then use democratic institutions themselves to undermine the democratic process, to tilt the playing field, to put themselves in an advantage, to weaken and disadvantage their opponents. We saw this in Turkey. We see it in Hungary. We see it in Venezuela and Ecuador. That has been the primary way by which democracy crumbles.
In a sense, I don't know. It's too easy an analogy, but the idea that the frog being placed in the boiling water or being placed in the water that then is set up to boil. I'm struck, for example, Stephen, by what polls found in Venezuela under Hugo Chavez and more recently under Nicolas Maduro, how people rated democracy there. What did they say?
Until very recently, a majority of Venezuela, until 2011, 2012, while Hugo Chavez was still alive, a majority, a solid majority of Venezuelans believed that they were living under a democracy. This is in part because most people in most countries kind of equate democracy with elections. And Venezuela continued to have, not only continued to have elections, but continued to have really hard-fought elections. So in that sense, it seemed democratic. But of course, democracy entails a whole bunch of other institutions that check executive power, that protect individual rights, the free press, freedom of association. Those things were being eviscerated in Venezuela. I'm not sure I would go as far as to use the frog in boiling water analogy, but they did happen slowly, they happened subtly, and they happened really as citizens often missed it before really it was too late.
Daniel Ziblatt, before we head to a break, since it gets used a lot and in the book as well, the term demagogue is used easily. What does it mean?
Yeah, so a demagogue is really a term, you know, that comes from classical Greek political, so it's an ancient term. And a demagogue is somebody who is popular, who makes appeals to the public, but does so in an irresponsible way. And so one of the things that's really tricky about democracy and a paradox of democracy, as Steve has laid out, is that, you know, we tend to think if somebody's democratically elected that that's the end of the story, that democracy will just survive. But what we've really seen is that when politicians come to power who use that power then irresponsibly, it really represents a threat to democratic institutions. And that's what demagogues are. You know, they may not necessarily have grand authoritarian plans, but they're power-seeking, and that's dangerous.
All right. A lot of cautionary notes sounded in the book, How Democracies Die, by Daniel Ziblatt and Stephen Levitsky, both professors at Harvard University. We'll come back and talk more with them and begin to take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guests are both professors of government at Harvard University, Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt, specialize in different parts of the world, but joined forces for a book that illustrates how governments go from places with democratic institutions and freedoms to places that have many fewer of those. The book is called How Democracies Die, and it is a cautionary note that focuses as well on the United States into and through the election of Donald Trump in 2016. You are welcome to join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Stephen, might as well broach this now. I know at least a few listeners who are also somewhat regular callers who will probably immediately write you off as a couple of lefties from Harvard. How would you dispel that view?
And one can disagree with who is sort of initially to blame for the what we describe as the erosion of democratic norms in the United States. It's true that we locate sort of the beginning of this downward spiral with the Republicans, with sort of the Gingrich Revolution in the 1990s. But that is not the most important point. The most important point is whatever side you're on, whether you're Democrat or Republican, we are now in a place where where our country, the democratic norms that sustained our democracy, made it function well, allowed our checks and balances to work for more than a century, are coming unraveled. And both parties are involved in this. Both parties are in effect to blame. And we need to find our way out. So it doesn't matter whether you're a liberal or conservative, a Democrat or a Republican. It's a problem facing all Americans. It's a challenge facing our democracy.
I'm imagining a few Democrats sitting here saying, how are we to blame? What would be the answer to that, Stephen?
Well, the Democrats just used a filibuster to carry out their first major government shutdown. That is following in the grand tradition of Newt Gingrich in the 1990s. That's an act that we call constitutional hardball. It is using the letter of the law, in this case a filibuster, in a way that really undermines its spirit. It contributes to dysfunctionality. We cannot, our system of checks and balances cannot work when the opposition party shuts down the government every time it's unhappy with what the majority is doing. That's a sign that our democracy is coming out of whack.
Okay, we'll get back to the United States in a few moments. I do want to get to some of the histories. Daniel, there's some great stuff in here about how Benito Mussolini leveraged what little power he had into much bigger power. Tell us that story.
Yeah, so in the book, we recount a couple of these really fascinating stories of how authoritarians got into power. We, again, you know, it's often through elections or through kind of normal channels, and Italy is a prime example of this. So, you know, in the early after 1918, World War One, Italian society was really in a great deal of turmoil. Benito Mussolini came along and had a mass following. He was a real outsider to the political system. The mainstream liberal political establishment was frightened of him. And a leading Italian statesman, Giovanni Giletti, you know, seeing the popularity of Mussolini, thought he could kind of tap into it but control this. And so he included Mussolini on a party list of his party to try to combat socialists in the early 20s. And this elevated the prestige of Mussolini. And within a year, not only had it elevated the prestige, he had kind of overcome Giletti himself and the liberal establishment. Before one knew it, Mussolini was now in power, and Giletti was kind of a footnote. So, you know, the lesson of that is really what often happens is authoritarians come into power with the aid of establishment politicians who think that they can use these and kind of form a Faustian bargain and use these politicians for their benefit. And at the end of the day, these Faustian bargains often backfire.
And with Hitler as well, experienced politicians helped him rise to power. What did they think they were going to get from him?
Yeah, so similar kind of story. It began really in the late 1920s, where there was a conservative party, a mainstream conservative party, that had had declining electoral fortunes, and they reached out to Hitler, thinking again that there would be a grassroots appeal to the party. They issued common programs, held rallies together. And very quickly, the conservative establishment politicians were sidelined, and Hitler kind of came to be incredibly popular. And right, you know, the way Hitler really got into power in January 1933, where a group of establishment, you know, statesmen, German statesmen, got together and they said, "Okay, we'll appoint him chancellor, but we'll have him kind of cornered, and we'll control him." And once Hitler, of course, was in power, the rest was history, and these guys were immediately dispensed with.
You know, nobody controlled Hitler. This is one of the many examples in the book, How Democracies Die, by Daniel Ziblatt and Stephen Levitsky from Harvard University. Stephen, let's move to your area of expertise in Latin America. Who was it who gave Chavez a boost, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela?
Well, Chavez is more of a bit more of an outsider than the cases that Daniel was talking about. The political parties in Venezuela were crumbling, but he received a crucial boost from former President Rafael Caldera. Caldera was one of the founders of Venezuelan democracy in 1958. He was a former president, a respected politician, who took several steps very late in his career as his career was waning. He wanted to come back and run for president again, something that's legal in Venezuela. But his star was kind of diminishing. He was aging. And he saw in connecting himself to Chavez an ability maybe to sort of reboost his public support. So when Chavez led a coup attempt, which is obviously a major assault on democracy, Caldera on the floor of the Senate voiced sympathy for him and his movement. And then when the Chavez's coup failed, he was jailed, and it was Caldera as president who pardoned him and released him from prison, which is obviously was critical to his rise to the presidency. So in Venezuela, too, the door to this populist outsider, the door for this populist outsider, was opened by an establishment politician.
Do the establishment politicians in the examples, Stephen, think that, hey, they'll be so grateful to me, they'll stay beholden to me?
No, they usually, in some cases, not in Venezuela, the expectation was this guy's just a flash in the pan. You know, people, he got on television, he was popular for a little while, but people are going to forget about him. There's some Caldera was quoted as saying that by the time the elections rolled around, people, Venezuelans would forget about Hugo Chavez. So he just underestimated Chavez.
This point is well underscored in the book, though. I mean, when he got into power in the first place, did Hugo Chavez talk like an autocrat at that time?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. He was a classic populist who treated his opponents as enemies, called them traitors. Was very, very critical of the establishment media, and basically promised to overturn Venezuela's democratic system.
So this moves us again back into our country, and we were talking about Donald Trump's rise to power just a little bit ago, Daniel Ziblatt. You were pointing out some of the things on the checklist. He had regarded the media as the enemy, didn't indicate he'd accept the results of the election if they didn't go his way, talked about locking up Hillary Clinton, was okay with violence, you know, and there are many examples in the book, you know, the idea of, like, we should knock the crap out of people who protest at the crowd, stuff like that. Now, the list you're going down here, though, you point out in the book, Daniel, is actually not one you guys created. Tell us about the political scientist Juan Linz and how old this list is.
Yeah, so we were inspired by a great political scientist who's no longer alive, Juan Linz, who was a professor for many years at Yale University and was actually born in Weimar, Germany, and grew up in Spain during the Civil War, and so really experienced these events that we've been describing firsthand. And he went on to a long career writing about democratic breakdown and the threats of democratic breakdown. And in the 1970s, he wrote a book called The Breakdown of Democratic Regimes. And in that, he's the one who proposed this idea that there's a kind of litmus test that we should use when looking at political leaders to try to evaluate whether they might be a threat to democracy if they come into power. And so we went through this book of his and use that to develop and kind of elaborate this litmus test. And, you know, really what he referred to and what we develop is, you know, first, does a politician reject democratic rules of the game? You know, if he does, then it's worrisome, or he or she does, it's worrisome. Does the politician deny the legitimacy of their political opponents? Do they basically think their political opponents don't have a right to compete for power? Do they tolerate or encourage violence? You know, which is, we've already mentioned, you know, candidate Trump violated this part of the litmus test, or passed this part of the litmus test. And then finally, the fourth dimension of our litmus test is, do they show a readiness to curtail civil liberties of opponents, including the media? So going after the media, again, is a classic hallmark of authoritarian. So Juan Linz really was an inspiration for this set of ideas, and we develop it and then apply it to cases all around the world as well as the United States.
So as you point out, you are not for banning populists, people who play like you know, man of the people. How then deal with them?
I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
So
yeah.
This is the role, in our view, of political leaders and particularly political parties. You're absolutely right. We do not advocate banning anybody from political competition. But the role of parties in a democracy is to serve as gatekeepers. Parties choose their own candidates. Major parties choose their own candidates. And they are ultimately responsible for screening out demagogues or screening out candidates or politicians who are potentially threatening to our democratic system. And our parties have done that quite successfully for most of this country's history.
Well, there's one point in particular that's really hard to imagine in America, and that is speaking out against the leader of your party when the party is in power, when you're a member of that party, and you're also in power, unless you're heading for the door, like Jeff Flake. I mean, it's just hard to imagine somebody who holds a position. And Mitt Romney, for example, you point out in the book, criticized Donald Trump when he was still a candidate, but Mitt Romney didn't hold any office of his own at that time.
One of the things that we really have noticed is, I mean, it's really clear, is that during the primary, there were many Republicans who were offended by Trump and who didn't like Trump and preferred other candidates, and really, you know, in fact, you know, really did not want Trump in some to be the nominee. But once the nominee, they kind of filed quickly behind him, and no elected official, national elected official of the Republican Party endorsed Hillary Clinton, which is something that we, you know, might expect, that essentially putting country before, or, you know, at least would hope that this might happen, that putting country before party. You know, at some level, you know, as you say, this might be unrealistic. But what's interesting, actually, is if you look around the world, and we recount some of these stories in the book, there are cases where something similar has happened. You know, actually, as recently as the 2017 French presidential election, we had a situation where Marine Le Pen, who is that country's populist demagogue, was, you know, almost won the presidency. In the first round, that France's leading Republican Party, so their main Republican center-right party candidate, François Fillon, didn't make it to the second round. And when he didn't make it to the second round, the final round was a showdown between Macron, who became president, who had been a cabinet minister in the socialist government, and Le Pen. And, you know, many people thought that in some sense Fillon was closer to Le Pen, who was also a rightist candidate. But he actually came out and endorsed Macron, and many of his voters followed him, and this made a big difference in the race. So, you know, this was a case here where politicians had already lived through the experience of having faced Le Pen's father, and so they had learned that this kind of putting country ahead of party at some points is necessary. So our hope is that, you know, going forward in the future, American politicians will understand that this is something that has to sometimes happen. This is a kind of strategy that's necessary to defend democracy. It's also a situation we've never been in before. So that's part of the reason I think American politicians, you know, put in this really tough situation of trying to figure out what to do, and from our judgment, made the wrong decision.
Daniel Ziblatt and Stephen Levitsky, both professors of government at Harvard University. They are the co-authors of the book How Democracies Die, with examples from many countries around the world. And yes, a focus on America under Donald Trump. You can join us on The Exchange. Agree, disagree, want to expound on a point? Let's hear it at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's go first to Skeeter in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hiya. Thanks for a great program this morning. Naomi Klein has a new book. It's called No Is Not Enough, and the subtitle is Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. She's really focusing on that it's, you know, how important it is for all of us to really think about a vision of where are we going? What do we want? What kind of world actually do we want for ourselves and our children, our grandchildren? And to perhaps have a Democratic Party agenda focused on a vision. And I would appreciate it if you all could give some feedback just on any recommendations that you have for so-called progressives.
All right,
and our resistance to Trump this year, because this is such a crucial year this year with all of the primaries and the elections.
Thank you for that, Skeeter. Stephen, let me take that to you.
Sure. Look, there has been, thinking specifically about resistance to Trump, and what I'm about to say may not be terribly popular, there's a lot of talk in progressive circles about progressive Democrats learning how to fight like Republicans.
Like with the shutdown, for example.
Like with the shutdown, or there's talk about if the Democrats regain control of the Senate, perhaps Democrats should refuse to grant President Trump the right to fill a new Supreme Court vacancy, as the Republicans did to President Obama. There's also talk, a lot of talk, and there will be more talk in the 2018 campaign about impeachment. Many Democrats will run on a platform of impeaching Trump. Now, it may be that what Mueller ultimately uncovers merits impeachment. It may well be that President Trump ought to be impeached. But impeachment is an extreme tool. It's a very, very powerful tool, and it's something that needs to be used with great caution. And that if it is used, it should be a bipartisan mechanism. So we advocate in the book that it's very costly, it's very dangerous for Democrats to learn how to fight like Republicans, because what it will do almost inevitably is reinforce and even accelerate the process of norm erosion that's beginning to threaten our democracy. And when a Democrat is elected, whether it's 2020 or 2024, if we continue to destroy the sort of protective guardrails that protect our democracy, our next Democratic president will be vulnerable to shutdowns, to impeachment efforts, to all kinds of hardball politics. And we just can't sustain democracy that way.
Another call here from Jacob in Springfield. I apologize for dropping your line a moment ago. Welcome to The Exchange.
So I wanted to compliment you on your expertise, but there's something that you are missing. You know, it's government and diplomacy and history and everything else, but you're missing out on mental illness and psychiatry. So what did Napoleon, Hitler, Stalin, and probably Hugo Chavez, and maybe Saddam Hussein are all in common? They were psychotic, okay? And so they were also sociopaths. And a lot of the leaders who get to the upper stages, eventually we're going to come up with someone who is a bipolar, narcissistic megalomaniac with touches of psychosis and sociopathy, and they don't listen, and they don't, you know, read, and they don't pay attention, and they don't know reality. And so what we say in a room of 100 people, 2% of them are psychotic. You know, and so eventually you're going to encounter that crazy psychotic person as your leader of your country. You know, it's almost like having your crazy uncle who's racist, who has paranoid, you know, ideations and conspiracy theories, and making them the head of, you know, your family.
All right, thanks for the
thoughts. It all starts with the dysfunctional mind.
All right, thanks for that, Jacob. Appreciate that. And we'll have to wait to get a response from one of our guests here.
It's true that we're not psychiatrists, and we're not, you know, Daniel and I are not in a position to discuss mental illness. But this gets to the point that we made earlier, which is that it is the parties and party leaders' jobs to filter out dangerous candidates. And the Republican Party essentially abdicated that responsibility in 2016. There was somebody about whom there was real questions, whether it's psychological or lack of experience or is authoritarianism, you know, choose your poison. But if there were real questions about whether Donald Trump was fit for office, it was the responsibility of the Republicans to keep him out, and they didn't do it.
All right, we'll talk about how they could have done that. The book is called How Democracies Die. Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Zablatt, the authors, back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. A provocative book in front of us today called How Democracies Die by Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Zablatt, both professors of government at Harvard University. Yes, we get a chance to look at how democracies have died in other parts of the world, but there is certainly a focus back on the United States and the election of Donald Trump in 2016 and what that perhaps tells about the direction we could be going if we are not careful. So the book not only provides some historical checklists that Donald Trump seems to meet, but also some guidelines from other countries that have managed to not fall into the anti-democratic trap. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Agree, disagree. Let's hear from you at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Stephen, you were just talking about how the Republican Party failed to deal with Donald Trump in a way that would have gotten him out. Now, there's a good bit of history in the book about how presidential candidates by party who were once chosen by people in the so-called smoke-filled rooms, that moved to a very primary-heavy system. Either one of those, I mean, what kinds of tweaks would have helped keep Trump out?
Well, it's not clear that any tweak would have. I mean, there are a lot of positives, a lot of benefits to a primary system as we have today. But one of the points of the book is that every candidate selection system has trade-offs. And the old system, the convention system, in which party leaders were ultimately the ones choosing candidates and voters had very little say, that was a pretty exclusionary system and not a very democratic one. The benefit of it is that party leaders were actually really good at screening out dangerous candidates. There was a process that a couple of political scientists have called peer review, in which it's the people who've worked with these guys face to face for years who really know what their qualities are, know whether they're fit for office. They know far better than voters if someone is fit for office or not. The upside of a primary system, of course, is much more open, it's much more democratic, and most of us think that's a good thing. But there's a risk. Basically, party leaders are taken out of the process, or taken at least partially out of the process, and are no longer able to play a gatekeeping role. So the way that the primary system, particularly the Republican primary system, which has no superdelegates, is structured, there wasn't a heck of a lot that Republican leaders could do, except, which is something that we mentioned earlier, which is if Trump wins the nomination and you decide that he's a threat, better back the other candidate. They didn't do that.
Well, so into the hypothetical now. I mean, you guys seem to indicate that if congressional leaders had spoken up against Donald Trump, if the likes of Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell had said this is not a good guy for the country, that would have made a difference. Is that fair, you think, Daniel?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to know for sure, certainly, but we think that you know, had all leading Republican officials, elected officials, come out and said we endorse Hillary Clinton, there, you know, certainly Donald Trump would have continued to receive lots of support, and there would have been lots of resentment about this. But you know, we tend to think that the odds are this may have tilted things in the other direction, and we would have avoided this. I mean, another way to think about this, you know, and the idea that there's kind of this peer review that, as Steve described it, I mean, the Democratic Party has a system of superdelegates where around 15% of delegates are elected officials who worked up close with the candidates and so on. You know, one thing to think of, and the Republican Party does not have this. You know, if the Republican Party did have a superdelegate system, you have to kind of wonder, would have Donald Trump won, and would if he even run? You know, because he may have thought he would have never made it over that hurdle. And so, you know, there's a lot of debate now about whether or not the Democratic Party should get rid of their superdelegates. There's a lot of people pushing for this. You know, I think we tend to think that there's actually reason to have superdelegates, and they've served the Democratic Party pretty well. So in any case, this is going to be an ongoing debate. And, you know, what the whole point of this is that there are flaws in the way we select our presidential candidates. And this has now brought this to the fore, and this is going to be something that we're going to continue to think about.
Let's take another call. Here's Jan in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Daniel Zablatt and Stephen Levitsky, the authors of How Democracies Die.
Hi there. I just wanted to follow up on your comment about not having the Democrats act like the Republicans. Could you comment on how they should maybe respond, knowing that the Republicans don't seem to be showing any inclination of lightening up on their partisanship?
In other words, if somebody doesn't compromise, how do you compromise? Is that the essence of it?
Right. It seems that the Democrats always have to move towards the Republicans, but the Republicans just, you know, never seem to move. And you know, how do you, it's like Lucy pulling the football away from Charlie Brown.
Right. Okay. Fair thanks enough. For that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good analogy.
No, I think it's worth pointing out that that there are no easy choices here. There's no easy way out. There's no silver bullet strategy for the Democrats that's going to lead us to the promised land. We're in a difficult situation, one in which we've got a president who's not fully committed to democratic rules of the game, and two, we face a situation of really intense partisan polarization and norm erosion. So we're in a tough spot, and it's true that that Democrats run the risk of facing an endless series of sucker punches if they don't fight back like Republicans. That we have to acknowledge that. What we advocate is a vigorous opposition, a muscular opposition, but opposition in defense of norms rather than an opposition that breaks norms. For example, I mean, the most central thing, the most important thing the Democrats can do is win the 2018 election. You know, winning at least one House of Congress would make a huge difference.
And so use the institutions that exist rather than perverting the ones that are there.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And I would add to this, you know, to not compromise, you know, to say that we need to abide by democratic norms does not mean we need to push, and Democrats don't need to push hard for civil rights, for the issues they believe in, environmental protection, you know, rights for immigrants. If these are the things and the values that are important to Democrats, and this is the kind of vision, this goes back to an earlier caller's question as well. If there's a vision that Democrats have of the kind of society they want to, you know, that they want to create, you know, you have to fight for these things, but within the established rules and norms of a democracy. Because if one sort of puts substance above procedure and sort of foregoes the rules and the norms, you know, you'll end up with neither. And so it's really, I think, important, we think, that Democrats fight for these issues through existing institutional channels. You know, protests and marches are an important part of that, but continue to try to remain committed to democratic norms.
So, Daniel, let me take it outside our country for just a moment, because I want to get a little additional perspective. When I look at the likes of Hungary and Poland, places that were just crying for freedom for decades, got it, and yet they've turned rather nationalistic and authoritarian themselves. What happened, for example, in Hungary?
Yeah, so, I mean, Hungary was not aided by its institutional structures in many ways. I mean, I think we have the benefit of having lots of checks and balances, a federal system, you know, the elections, you know, congressional elections in separate years from the presidential elections. I mean, what happened in Hungary is one party came to power in a parliamentary system and had a very large majority and then used that transitory majority to alter institutions in very dramatic ways, you know, forcing early retirement of judges so that the prime minister could appoint judges that he wanted to appoint, changing media laws, changing the election rules so that the elections would be tilted in favor of the incumbent. So all of these things came very rapidly. And it's because the party had in power had this kind of dominant majority that it could then leverage that into even a stronger majority, or, you know, a majority that was harder to undo. And so, you know, in some ways, I think the U.S., you know, this idea that our checks and balances can protect us, there's something really to that. You know, the fact that we have this election coming up in fall 2018 can send an important signal and can lead to divided government, which can serve as a check. So I think in many ways, you know, the institutions that we have helped protect us and can hopefully continue to help protect us. And a country like Hungary was in a very different situation.
Well, you know, Viktor Orban certainly says it's all for the country's good. I mean, I guess I find myself wondering if in some level they think it is for the good. Tim in Eureka asks us a little more elegantly than I am. He says, have there been cases in history where the reaction to only a perceived threat ends democracy? In other words, has anti-fascism instilled fascism?
Yeah, well, that's really what we're afraid of. I mean, there's two points there, I think. Number one, that this a kind of spiral can be unleashed in which, and that's why we're nervous about and making these, you know, giving you these warnings about how Democrats should behave. Because what happens is if an authoritarian acts in ways and speaks in ways that frighten the Democratic opposition for good reason, the Democratic opposition has a tendency and can might be tempted to overreact. And this then only reinforces the authoritarian tendencies of the authoritarian incumbent. And so you kind of get this dangerous spiral. Each move kind of puts you further down the spiral. And so that's why, you know, it's really important to Democrats, you know, resist that temptation. A second point is just the threat, the possibility of a kind of crisis. I mean, one thing that we're very worried about, and we've seen in other countries, is when there is a crisis, a national security crisis, assassination, terrorist attack, this is a moment where somebody who's been chipping away at democratic institutions for a couple of years grabs power. And so this is something, again, we have to keep our eye on.
Let us take another call from, she's gone. Let's go to Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I have been listening carefully to what you've been saying. A book that's very important to me in this department and this issue is The Spirit and Structure of German Fascism by Robert A. Brady. And he was a professor of economics at UC Berkeley in the 1930s when that book was published. And he was suppressed afterwards because he said in the book, in more than one place, especially in the last chapter, that the fascistic spiral, as you're talking about, could easily happen in this country. And he was saying that back in the 1930s. Another book that's important to me is The Power Elite by C. Wright Mills. You put those two books together with your book, and you really have a good education in the dangerous era that we're living in right now politically.
All right, Carter, thanks for that. Thoughts from either one of you guys?
Yeah, no, I mean, we really encourage people to read works of history, and that's part of one of the things we're trying to do with our book, is to bring history of the 1930s and 1920s into dialogue. You know, we're not saying that we are, you know, Weimar Germany about the fascism's around the corner, but on the other hand, you know, if we read this history, the kind of history we recount and, you know, other works have done as well, it's a way of kind of just being aware of the threats.
As you point out in the book, how you label opponents is critical. There's lots of examples, but I do want to bring it back into our borders again. You guys mentioned Newt Gingrich much earlier in the show. As he rose to power in the Republican Party in Congress, he began telling people they should label their opponents sick and pathetic and traitors, and there was quite a list there. Now, but the likes of Newt Gingrich and Rush Limbaugh insist they're only telling the truth. So, Stephen Levitsky, how do you combat that?
It's very difficult to combat. It's particularly difficult to combat in today's media environment. You know, in back when we were growing up, there was a much simpler media environment, for better and worse, in which you had a small number of establishment media sources that had quite a bit of credibility across the political spectrum. That those days are over, and so it is very difficult to convince partisans on either side that what the other side is saying is factually correct. We cannot agree on the facts, and unfortunately, we don't have an answer to that. That's something that, as a society and as a polity, we're going to have to learn how to live with.
You know, economic inequality figures large in many examples of places where democracies shifted over to more authoritarian systems. And I wonder if perpetuating that inequality while complaining about it and promising to end it has ever been a technique. Daniel, is that something?
Perpetuating it while promising to end it?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, we think economic inequality is a problem for democracy. I mean, at a basic level, you know, there's a tension between economic inequality and political equality. But even more than that, I think, you know, in many ways, the situation that the U.S. faces is, you know, the most highest levels of inequality in a century, at least. And that's not unrelated to the crisis we're in. You know, this, first of all, generates lots of resentments. And we think this, combined with the ethnically diverse society that we've thankfully become, has generated ethnic tensions as well. And this is something, you know, you look around the world, combinations of economic inequality and ethnic diversity are a potent, dangerous combination, because there's the opportunities for demagogues to use resentments and, you know, kind of backlash against democracy and against targeting of groups. And so, you know, this is certainly a kind of risk, I think, that the U.S. faces. And so one of the things we really think that needs to happen, in addition to kind of continue to play by democratic norms and building up democratic norms, is to address fundamental levels of economic inequality in the United States. This would be a way of helping preserve American democracy. You know, that's a major topic, you know, that we could have a whole separate show on.
Sure.
How to reduce economic inequality. But this, we definitely should flag this as being one of the important issues.
Ultimately, Stephen Levitsky, are you guys optimists?
I think we are tempered optimists. We're cautious optimists. I mean, we do believe that American democratic institutions are strong. We are not Hungary. We're not Russia. We're not Turkey. We have a much better chance of surviving this challenge than these other countries. And we're also a country with a history of ethnic integration. We overcame the tensions generated by large-scale immigration in the early part of the 20th century. And so, yeah, at some level, I am optimistic that we can overcome it again, that we can become really the world's first truly multi-ethnic democracy.
We
have to be aware that we face serious challenges.
All right. Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Zablatt at Harvard University wrote How Democracies Die. Thank you both.